Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Here is the only man in the world who could have made this movie, Terry Gilliam. Okay.
Is this going to work? Hello.
I think this is going to work. Hello. I feel far away from you, but congratulations on this movie.
Reach across here. Yeah.
Since we're here tonight with the Society of Composers and Lyricists, I have this dream that when Oscar night comes around, they're going to get to do a production number of We Are the Children of the World, the song that you wrote, which is a sort of takeoff on all these sort of feel-good charity celebrity
totally.
Songs. Could you talk about that song?
Well, I mean, I know Michael's dead, but I always hated that song that he wrote. And it's and so one had to deal with our concern for the children of the world in as pathetic and satirical a way as possible. I think it's really funny because it's been nominated for the Satellite Award for the best song. And I wrote it as a joke. it's that awful saccharine, sentimental thing, children as victims, and it makes me crazy.
And, of course, the other song, We Love Violence, harkens back to Monty Python tunes.
Yeah, I had to write something. I had to have him sing something. And I thought, how do you deal with a bunch of Russian thugs that are dangerous? And I thought, well, the best thing to do is try to confuse them with music and lure them into the police force with a kind of high-kicking number, encouraging them to do what they do best, which is be violent. So we wrote it and we did it, and you probably wouldn't appreciate it, but the credit is through the Sir Ian Blair Memorial Choir, and Ian Blair was the police commissioner in London when Menendez, the Brazilian guy, was shot, thinking he was a terrorist, and I thought Ian Blair should be remembered for his fine work at protecting the innocent.
Watching this film, I had mentioned Monty Python, but this is the type of movie that evokes so many of your other works. It just feels like not a summary of your career, because we assume you're going to keep working, but it evokes so many of your movies. Could you talk about, is that something you specifically had in mind, or is that just how it came out?
Well, it was, I did actually say when Charles McCune and I started writing it, to try to think of it as a compendium of things I've done and the ideas that I've been interested in. I was actually thinking at the time of Fellini's Amarcord and Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, because I thought both of those films were done by those directors at a specific point in their life when they kind of relaxed for a bit and just did what they had done earlier, happy, joyful, and that was the way we kind of approached that.
So what got you to that point where you were ready to do that?
I was worn out, I think. I mean, at a certain point, it was curious because I hadn't written anything original, truly original, since Brazil. And it was really... can I do it anymore? And literally, we started with just a blank piece of paper, no real idea, no story, no characters. And little by little, we started accruing things, and suddenly there was a story full of characters.
And Imaginarium is not I sort of, when I hear the title, I sort of know what it's going to mean, but it's not a real thing, right?
No, I don't think so. But there was always that Victorian thing. They were always using... words with a Latin ending like that to give it some dignity. Something great was going on. The Imaginarium. And we went with it. I also like the idea of just a title with more syllables than any other film has ever had for a title, and see if people can actually learn to say more than one syllable at a time. Imaginarium. That's a lot. And it looks great in London when it was on the marquee of the cinema. You couldn't... I mean, it was squeezing everything out. They got all the words up there one day, and it was fantastic.
And how did the sort of look of the film come together? Because it has this really wonderful mix of sort of new style and old style, mainly old style effects.
Yeah, I mean, on the effects of the whole thing you're talking about.
Yeah, the whole sort of look of it.
Well, the idea was the Imaginarium was probably Victorian. And I've always loved the old sideshows, freak show The way it was done with big canvases with the paintings of the three-headed man, the woman slithers on her belly like a reptile. And that always intrigued me. So it was part that, part toy theater. I always loved those Victorian toy theaters. And so it's a combination of all the things I would probably like to have been able to play with when I was a kid and we couldn't afford or didn't know about.
And could you tell us a bit about your process in creating these? I mean, do you sort of do sketches like, sort of on your own, and then hand these to some production designer who has
wiggle a pencil around the page? And I drew the theater pretty accurately right from the beginning, and then you work with really good people. And I was working with Dave Warren and Anastasia Massaro. Anastasia handled the Canadian side because it was a UK Canadian co-production. She did the Canadian stuff, and Dave did the stuff in London. We just started drawing. That's the advantage for me, because I can draw. It's half the communication process when you're making a movie, whether it's the costume department or the sets. So we start drawing. Ideas come in. We pull in photographs, pictures, ideas, and slowly the thing develops into what it is.
Now, of course, there's a bunch of questions to ask about the actors in the film. I want to start by asking about Lily Cole, who's Valentina, who has such an unusual and great quality, because I think your films always are in this world between childhood and adulthood, and she epitomizes that. But
again, looking for a daughter for Parnassus, and I thought she had to be extraordinary, and extraordinary looking as well. So Lily's, very tall, and she's got this head that belongs on a Victorian porcelain doll. It's just bigger than a doll's head, but it's almost the perfect proportions, these great eyes, this tiny mouth. And I met her, the British the casting director, Irene Lamb, had worked with her on, there was a little film that Sally Potter did, I think it was called Rage, and Lily had done a monologue there, and she said she's very good, she's very interesting. I met her, she was very smart, very self-possessed. We screen tested her, and she wasn't bad, she wasn't great, but I just thought, there's something about this girl. And then threw her into that pit of great actors, and she floated right up to the top.
So, of course, I have to ask about Heath Ledger. And first of all, the first thing I want to ask is just what was the quality about him that drew you to cast him in the first place?
Well, he actually asked to be in the movie. That made it easier. Is Heath and I mean, after Brothers Grimm, we're very close. I mean, yeah. Heath, to me, was just the most extraordinary actor. And he was just getting better all the time. Yeah. He was playful, he was smart, he was always grounded. It was very special. He was a really close friend. And he was in London when he was doing The Joker for Dark Knight, and he was at the time working on a music video, and I put him in an office at our effects company, and there was one day he was there, and I was going through the storyboards with the effects guys up on a big screen, and he slipped me his note in the middle of it saying, "Can I play Tony?" Yeah. And that was it.
I mean, I see you sort of tearing up thinking about him.
That's terrible. I mean, no, and Heath was very close. And when you're in the middle of a film like this, halfway through, and he dies, was beyond a shock. But everybody basically pulled together and forced me to get off the floor and work out how to fix it.
What's so odd, of course, is that there's an aura about that the fact that he's played by different people has that works in a way that's powerful, but it's hard to think about how you were able to work through that at the time.
I mean, it was inherent in what we had done. I mean, there's very little change in the script after Heath died. Once we made the leap to use three other actors to complete the part, because it had already been established in the script that if you go through the mirror with somebody else, their imagination may be stronger than yours, so you may end up looking like their dream man as opposed to the way you look. And that worked. So I added certain lines, like when the Louis Vuitton woman, as she's called, the lady from the shopping precinct, when she pulls the mask up and sees Johnny, I just added the line, "Oh, I dreamed you would always look like this." So that was what we did. With the drunk at the beginning, I had his face change again to establish his principle. Yeah. And it just seems to work seamlessly. I've come to believe in the film gods that are actually making the movie, not me. There's some force up there that's making it. And to get Johnny, Colin, and Jude, they were just a perfect, to me, trio to take over the various aspects of Tony's character.
This is sort of a heavy-handed thematic question, but I wonder how much the film seems to be saying something about the place of the artist in a very commercial modern world, you know, and this is sort of a fight you've been fighting for about 40 years at least. So could you talk
it was always to me, because the first idea that really started forming this was the first shot, this extraordinary theatrical wagon coming into a modern city, and it opens up. And there's this amazing, outrageous, antique, bizarre show going on. Wonderful, though. And nobody's paying attention. And that just seemed to be pretty much, I think, anybody who's got any artistic qualities, sensibilities, understands the feeling.
Yeah. Okay, I want to open it up to the audience. So I'll repeat your question so everybody can hear. So right there. Okay, why choose films that are about the conflict between fantasy and reality rather than just doing a pure fantasy?
I don't know what pure fantasy is. It's the reality. It doesn't really interest me. I mean, what interests me is that relationship, how one informs the other. I mean, we live in a world where we're basically inventing the world around us every day, if we think about it. And if it's not you personally inventing the world you're in, it's certainly the media is inventing a world
right.
for you. And I've always just been intrigued by how, you know, you need fantasy to make the world an interesting enough place or a more fantastic place, but you need your feet on the ground all the time. And so it's this, to me, it's permanent conflict. And I've never quite worked out the exact borderline, so I keep trying each film to do another version of it and see if which one is getting closer to the truth.
Okay, over here. Okay, I guess he's saying you started making films in what he says is a much more open time in the 60s and 70s creatively. Then how do you see the situation today?
I would learn spot welding or carpentry, something useful, personally. I don't know how you do it now. I mean, luckily there's the web there, and you've got your little digital camera, and you can cut the stuff at home on your computer. Fantastic. And you can get it out there, and people on the web can see your work. And I don't know how you make a living doing that, but it's certainly a way of showing what you can and cannot do. When I was starting, I managed to save up enough money to buy a Bolex 16mm camera. And I was living with two other guys in this flat up in the west side of Manhattan. And every weekend, I'd go and buy a 3-minute roll of film. And whatever the weather was, we would write a little film story and go out and shoot it, get some friends in, wear some costumes. And that's how he played and tried to learn a little bit about filmmaking. And that was it. But, I've been astonishingly lucky. Forget about what the times were like then. Python was in a situation where we'd become quite popular. And Britain was in a situation where if you made a lot of money, you could end up paying 90% tax. Suddenly there was a lot of pop stars who happened to like Python who were looking for some tax relief. We were it. And then two of us, Terry Jones and I, raised our hands and said anybody named Terry should be able to direct this thing. And the others agreed. And that's how I became a director. So I'm not a very good example for most people. I mean, my trick was to start at the top and work down, which I haven't worked down as low as I had hoped I would by now.
But of course, your first films that you were famous for were the little animations you did. And there's something about the spirit of the animator, because animation is really the form of filmmaking where everything does start from scratch, like starts from a blank page. And you, this film... it's a live-action film, but it really has the spirit of an animated film.
Yeah. I think that the problem now is, and what you're talking about, is it's a very bad time for films, and even for people who have got experience and a track record. It's terrible. I mean, the studios are all contracting. They're just deciding to do, you know, franchise films, and you know, maybe just a few a year, and they'll all be above $100 to $200 million budgets. Or you make your little romantic comedy, if you're lucky, for under $10 million. It's outside in the independent sector. In America, many of the independent companies have been basically run out of town by the studios, and then the studios closed down their little cadet branches. And not good time. The rest of the world, there's still ways of getting money, and that's where I am at this point, raising money outside. But at least I've got a reputation, and I know how difficult it is. I mean, this film, interestingly enough, you go to Hollywood in 2007 with that script, with Heath Ledger, the cast we had, and in the end, all we needed to get out of this country for North America, for the U.S. was $4 million.
Hmm.
We couldn't get it. So,
really?
You know, those were the good days. It's worse now.
Wow.
So it's not a good time, and that's why I think spot welding is the thing.
Okay, right over here. So the directors right now who are working that you're excited by?
I actually don't watch films very often. I mean, it really is true. I just don't. I mean, I just, you know, the Coen brothers I always love. I don't know. That's the kind of question I don't actually have an answer for, because I don't know who's out there and what they're doing. They're a threat to me is all I know.
Okay, over here. So the question about the evolution of the makeup design with Christopher Plummer's character, for example.
It was just kind of a bold leap is what it was, because, I mean, Chris is 78. It's very hard to pull all of his face behind his ear. So, you know, we start doing all those basic things that one would do, you know. And it's still, he's looking, you know, a certain age. So it was just a bold idea, because, you know, we thought, okay, people use coal around their eyes in a lot of Middle Eastern countries. So let's be bold, just a woof. We also just painted it in a cheek, very obvious, and just decided to do it stylized and say that's what they do in that part of Tibet or wherever it is. The interesting thing that I don't know how many of you noticed is the chant they're doing, because in fact it's a very rare and unique form of Tibetan Judaism, because they're actually saying Om Vey. These are the things we do to entertain ourselves when we're making the movie.
Okay. It's a little hard to see through the spotlight, but over here. Did you have some... because of the Fisher King in this, did you have some childhood desire to climb ropes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a tree house. It was three stories high. I built it out of the old outhouse that we had a two-seater in Minnesota. And when finally we got an indoor toilet, my father and I broke up the old two-seater out there in the back garden and built a three-story tree house. So climbing has always been thing I've loved, whether it be trees or ropes. I used to actually, in high school, I was a pretty good gymnast, and I could just go up a rope, no legs, just boom, boom, boom. I was good. I was young. I was strong. I'm old now. These are just distant memories.
Okay, over here. Okay, so if you could talk about the choice of composer, Michael Dann, I guess, and how the scoring works.
Well, Michael and Jeff did the score for Tideland, a previous film, and they did it because it was a UK-Canadian co-production, and I had to use a Canadian, so I was forced to use them. But it was one of those things that was great. I mean, I'd always liked Michael's music on the Egoyan films, Adam Egoyan films. I thought they were extraordinary. And it was interesting in that instance because Michael said yes, and then he wasn't totally available because Adam's film that was supposed to be delayed suddenly happened. So he brought his brother Jeff in, and it was the combination of the two of them that worked very well on Tideland. And so I brought them in on this one. And there's a scene that isn't in there when the little kid runs into the mirror at the beginning. There's this amazing children's fantasy world. It went further, and at one point there were 1,000 kids learning to play the piano. And Michael wrote a tune for them to play, which then became the Parnassus tune that keeps bouncing around through it. And they just dove in. In some ways, I was less involved in the day-to-day business of the score on this one than normal because I trusted him. And they just started grabbing these very interesting sounds. I mean, that's what one of the things I like about both of them. Their instrumentation is fantastic. And they're coming up with wonderful themes, and we just went with it. And there's a lot of juggling around. You try a theme there, I'll work better over here. And eventually we've got it worked out, all the different musical sections. And then we scored it in Budapest. And so there's some wonderful stuff, and there's dulcimers, which is the thing you could really find there. There's some great sort of almost klezmer violin playing, and a lot of nice sort of Eastern sounds. I mean, I personally have always been very keen on particularly gypsy music from Hungary, Romania, that area. It's fantastic, the rhythms, the instrumentation. And so there's a lot of that going on in there. But normally when I'm working on a film, I'm just sitting on the composer day after day. When we were doing, I remember doing Brazil with Michael Kamen. He would have his grand piano there, and this is the early days, and he'd have a little monitor there with the old VHS tape. And we would start playing the scene, and go. And Michael would be on the piano, and I'm just like, and Michael's grabbing chords, but little arpeggios, and I'm all of this. And then we'd stop, and we recorded all that, and then we'd play it back, and we'd say, that was really good. Well, that was wonderful. Let's use that and let it grow. And those were days I was much more involved in that sense. It's nice to find somebody like the Danas and learn to trust them. So they were constantly surprising me with wonderful themes, and that was how it went.
Okay, right over here. So he says your style is very recognizable in every frame of your films. He's asking specifically about use of canted angles, of wide-angle lens, and the sort of...
It's really funny. People talk about, you know, oh, it's instantly identifiable when they look at my films. I don't know what they're talking about, frankly. To me, it looks normal. It just seems, how else does the world look? That's really what it is. It's not like an intellectualization of it. It's just that's the way I see the world. I think it's coming from being a cartoonist. You know, you abstract and you stretch things. Now, and wide-angle lenses, I like for a couple of reasons, because when I'm looking through the camera, I keep saying, oh, let's go wider on this. Because when I'm looking through the camera, it's like I'm almost trying to get into the scene. And the wide-angle lens seems to make it possible to get in there. And when I see it on film, what I love is it's filling up your peripheral vision more. There's more information out there. So it's about, for me, a lot of the times, it's people in an environment is what it's about. There's a dialogue between the background and them. And so I end up doing that. I just like clutter as well. I just like, you know, when I'm working on a film, I tend to sometimes, I don't get bored. I'm just running out of... chances to do more things, so I keep adding more bits and pieces in there in the image, and then and we're setting up the shots. I'm always trying, oh, a little bit there, and it's like that, and so it's done in just a very instinctive way, as opposed to anything else. I mean, the idea is urban decay, that just is something that's always been with me. I'm really happy in the country, and I come to cities, and I always see the bad side of them, it seems to me. I think I was born in the country, and it's always stuck with me. Other than that, Dutch angles are things that I've always played with a bit, because you can just get a different angle. When we did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, we did it really consciously, Dutching, so the horizon was never level. There's only one point in the film where suddenly, when it gets really freaky, and we level the horizon, hopefully everybody's been so used to this, and begin thinking that's normal, and suddenly it goes straight. It's like, that should be shocking, and it actually does work that way a bit. And it's nothing much more than that. I think you're more involved. When I watch some of the earlier films with even slightly wider angle lenses, I actually find it disturbing because when I'm in the audience, I'm in the screen. It's surrounding me. Mm. So it's a little bit claustrophobic, which in some instances I think improves the experience. Yeah, I think hyper-reality is what it is. I mean, I don't know how to make a truly naturalistic film. I don't see things that way. And in a strange way, I like what we do is, in a sense, saying this is artifice. This is not the natural, real world. This is an impression of it. Because I find films that are done in sort of handheld, kitchen sink, Daco style, is in a way it's cheating, because I think people think that's more truthful, more honest, a more true representation of the world. And I disagree with that. I think it's just a technique that makes it look that way. But you can lie really well doing that kind of technique.
And of course, in this film, and so many of the scenes were sort of in people's imaginary world, so that...
Yeah, and that gives you a chance to suddenly... I mean, sometimes we play with that, where you use longer lenses, and then you go through the mirror, and then it breathes, and suddenly it goes like that. And so we're pushing it sometimes. Sometimes the wide-angle lenses are just because we're in that little theater, and there's no room. You have no idea how tiny that place was. And to actually get a shot, you had to use a wide-angle lens.
Right. Okay. Over here. So this is praise for Tom Waits' performance, and how did you choose him, and then how did you work with him?
Well, I mean, Tom was in Fisher King briefly, just before the big waltz in Grand Central Station, so we're friends, and his connection on this one began with there was a Dutch animator, a friend of mine, who wanted Tom to do some voices in his animation. I sent this material to Tom, and he didn't want to do it. And he wrote me back saying, "Yeah, I don't want to do this, but Terry, you got anything for me here?" And I said, "Well, Tom, I've just written a part for the devil." He said, "Well, I'm in." And he didn't even he didn't read the script. He was in. Bingo. And he's one of the living gods out there. I mean, I worship this man. I think he's extraordinary. His music is just the best. I recently introduced him as saying, this is the man who writes songs for the angels and sings them with the voice of Beelzebub.
Yeah.
And that's Tom. So there was very little I had to do. This is, he knows that territory that the devil marches in. I loved his relationship with Chris Plummer. It's a great double act. And Tom started at one point ad-libbing a bit, because his use of words is just breathtaking. And there's a scene after Lily goes through the mirror into hell, and Parnassus is on his crag, and Mr. Nick turns up commiserating with him, and he says, "God, Bernie, I hate to see you like this. Can offer you a stick of gum or a breath mint." And that was his ad lib, and I fell off my chair when he did that. It was just wonderful.
did you allow much ad libbing or improv during the film? Because there's such great comic timing in the banter.
Well, some of it started with Heath, because Heath was just firing on all cylinders on this film. He was just having a ball. And he started ad libbing quite a bit. And I don't normally, you know, encourage it. But his ad-libbing was so precise. It was right on the button. Mm. And it was always within character. It wasn't skewing out there in the wrong direction. It was always there. And I just left him to do it, because he was getting he was enjoying it so much, and he was bringing a lot more into it with these ad-libs. Yeah. And that started Andrew Garfield, who had never ad-libbed before. He started doing it, and he was getting better. And it was quite interesting to watch that kind of confidence building. And Andrew was interesting because when Heath died, there was a void left there, well, on many levels, but Andrew kind of rose to the occasion, and his character became more confident, more, it was expanding more, and he started ad-libbing more. Mm-hmm. And he was also taking on, I think, some of the comic timing that Heath had been doing, and he just got funnier and funnier. I mean, that scene where he's in drag and the Russians are there, and he says, you know, put that man down, and what's, I can't remember what the lines are. What are you playing with? This is you're not in your room with your toys and your guns. This is a human being. And that was all ad-libbed. He just started flying. And it's really nice when you've got actors who gain that kind of confidence, and they're just enriching it all the time. Interestingly enough, Chris Plummer never ad-libbed. I mean, he's just too good a pro. And he made sure that the dialogue in the script was to his liking in rehearsals. And we discussed it all in advance. And then he didn't deviate. So it was you know, in some ways, many different acting styles all being thrown together. And somehow they all balanced each other. I mean, with Tom and Chris, it was like two musicians at work, because Chris's voice is, you know, it's just a great instrument, and he plays it beautifully. And the two of them, it was almost like a couple jazz players riffing, and they would bounce off each other rhythmically, and their tones were dancing. It was fantastic to watch the two.
Yeah, and the actors also, some of them were riffing on Heath in a way. I mean, Johnny Depp, I mean, the style of performance.
Yeah, well, that was an interesting one because Johnny, Colin, and Jude, all we were able to do was give them a DVD of some of the stuff we'd cut together with Heath. And when they arrived, there was no time to rehearse. And that was one of the reasons I was only asking friends of Heath to get involved, because they knew him well and they understood what he was like. So it was a kind of a shortcut to the characters. And I mean, Johnny was there, he turned up, no rehearsal, let's go, boom. And we had 1 day and 3.5 hours to shoot what you saw in film. Woof, amazing, just brilliant. And Jude and Colin in some ways had the most difficult job because it's the longest part. Yeah. And he pulled it off. He said it certain days he felt he was actually channeling Heath. I mean, his spirit was hanging over this whole thing. It was more like a weight. The fact that, are we going to do something worthy of Heath for his last movie? It was like this burden we were carrying. And nobody knew whether what we were doing was going to work. We just had marched forward. And it was incredibly complicated, the scheduling us and the three guys, because they were doing other things, and we were constantly having to shift and turn. We'd have it set on a stage, and suddenly, somebody was available. We had to pull that set off, put another one in. It was a full-blown nightmare is what it was. But hopefully it doesn't show on film. I hope it feels smooth and happy and wonderful.
And playful. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think we have time for one more, so go ahead. What is the significance of the Percy character?
He makes everybody look tall. That's his function. Vern Troyer is there to make the rest of us look tall. Come on. Percy is the cynic. Percy is the one that probably knows the truth about Parnassus. Parnassus may be lying to all of us. I don't trust him for one moment. Come on, who's 1,000 years old? Do you believe that sort of thing? Yes, I know. I do, too. Percy is also Jiminy Cricket to his Pinocchio, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how long Parnassus's nose got on this film, but he's his conscience. He's the one that sees through Parnassus's bullshit, if that's what it is. He's also the snappiest dresser.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I think I hope that you continue to not see other people's movies, so you keep thinking that you're making normal films, and come back with your next one. But congratulations on this.
Thank you.
That was great. Thanks.